Well, good morning. It's Thursday. It's 11 o'clock. It's time for Green Zine here on WFVRLP South Royalton.
Said oaks, they sway to the breeze of my tune. Makes the sound so much sweeter about you. They go waltzing after midnight around me.
Starting off with some old-time music. And we have a lot of old-time players around here. These guys are great. Colin Morrison and Eli West with Fiddlehead Fern. Maybe you've been out checking out the fiddleheads, maybe harvesting a few to go with your meal. You are tuned to Green Zine here at Free Vermont Radio. Todd Tyson with you. Henry just about to join us. And we do want to acknowledge our underwriters here. And they include Soliflect. They're that tracking solar company based down in Norwich, Vermont. Bale, building a local economy. Find out more about what they're up to at balevt.org. I think they've got a new art opening coming up featuring Barnard artist Kate Reeves. Royal Trailworks, Tom Wells' business, designing snowmaking systems and trail building for skiing and riding in the wintertime. Daniel Leibowitz, our original treasurer and on our original board of directors back in the day, more than 11 years ago. Hey, Daniel, in case you're listening. Upper Pass Beer Company, the First Branch Coffee Company, Solar Fest, and the White River Land Collaborative holding a couple of events this weekend. They're having a special sort of sit-down dinner tomorrow night. I think if you go to their website, just look up White River Land Collaborative. You can find out more about that fundraiser. Or if you just want to come out to our more casual burger night that is coming up this coming Sunday. Well, let's see if we can talk to Henry. Good morning, Henry.
Good morning, Todd. And good morning, listeners.
Indeed.
Have you got any sun down there? The sun has come out in Burlington.
There was a little peak of sun, but it's mostly cloudy. And I guess the forecast earlier in the week was calling for sort of rain off and on for most of the days. But other than yesterday, I think we're just going to have cloudy and highs of, in fact, for like four straight days, highs of 61 each day for the next 4 days.
Yes, I don't know. So I was down there recently, and let's see, we're Thursday now. I guess I was down there on Monday, and your foliage at that point was just perfect. It was beautiful. Burlington is getting leafed in, but you people were still seeing the buds opening. And I commented, I guess, last week's show that, you know, stop and look at all of that happening in the spring because it's so miraculous. And when a sunny day comes along, it just gallops ahead. It's it's amazing how fast one day's warm, sunny weather will make.
Yeah, I was talking with someone who manages a few fruit trees and about the forecasts and with the rain and cloudy weather. And she was concerned about the pollinators. You know, if it was really damp and cloudy or rain coming down, that maybe some of those buds that need to be pollinated so that we'll get some fruit bearing trees later in the year. But I think we're going to make it. That I'm going to stay optimistic.
Yeah, and I don't see there's rainy days one after another in the forecast, but it's all showers. It's not rain all day. It isn't something that might wash the pollen off before the pollinators got to them.
Okay, that makes two optimists then. Very good.
Yes, I hope.
All right.
All right. We should. We have a little bit of today's show. We have a little bit of gloom and doom to kind of kickstart a conversation about non gloom and doom. And we have a bird, and I chose the Cooper's Hawk because I actually had one in the yard here, stalking the birds, and it was not only it not only kind of flew in, but it strutted around, kicking up, looking in the shrubbery and looking for bird's nest and young.
Ooh.
And I'm going to attempt to put a picture of it up on the website. I've never added a picture to the website.
Oh, advanced maneuver.
Sure.
Oh, you'll pull it off,
or
Henry.
Not? But advanced maneuver. And I'll go back in last week's show or in this week's show. If I get that picture in, I'll also do a picture of maybe a silver maple, I think is what it is. But the leaves opening up with all kinds of little, if you look very carefully, if I get that picture up, there are little fingers that are really flowers. They're miniature flowers that happen just as the leaf is coming out. So
why don't we go to our, well, I don't know if you've got chickens. I don't think the Cooper's Hawk is your friend, but it is a beautiful looking bird here.
You know, nature has, everyone has to eat something.
Yeah, they do. They do. So we'll go to that. And then when we come back, you'll give us a heads up on who our guests are going to be. We'll take care of a couple of other things. And it's going to be a busy day here on Green Zine at Royalton Community Radio. Let's go to Bird Note now.
This is Bird Note. Cities may have been created by humans for humans, but nature persists. Next time you're in the city, look up. When the pigeon flocks flash and flare, wheeling with a new urgency, you might just see a different bird, long-tailed and stiff-winged, in pursuit. Historically persecuted as chicken hawks, for many years, Cooper's Hawks were in steep decline due to hunting and the effects of DDT on breeding. Today, populations have rebounded to the point that it's now our most abundant bird-eating raptor. Male Cooper's Hawks are significantly smaller than the females, and they tend to prey on mourning doves, grackles, and other easy pickings at suburban bird feeders or in city parks and wooded residential areas. Their big, bulky mates can easily hunt and kill pigeons, and it's usually female Cooper's Hawks that are seen flapping stiffly through the skies above the concrete jungle. These hawks add a dash of wildness and drama to the modern cityscape. Look up, and you'll see evidence of nature's persistence in the form of pigeon feathers falling silently from the sky. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Well, thank you very much, Michael. And I don't know, they sound like primarily an urban bird there, Henry. Have you, well, of course, you've kind of been an urban area.
That was a take on them being urban. I think that they are, they're out in the broad country just as much. It's just that they aren't. And it's true for a lot of hawks. They like tall structures that they can land on and survey the landscape. Peregrine falcons nesting on high apartment buildings or in New York City and the like.
Yeah, well, there's a tall bridge that we travel across in mid-coast Maine, and I was thinking about certain birds, whether it be bald eagles and ospreys up there, more likely than a Cooper's hawk. And just as I was thinking about it, I looked up at the highest point of the bridge, and yep, there was a nest right at the very top. Who knows how far above the water? Probably 300 or 400 feet above the water. Yeah, pretty amazing.
Right. Fly or die when you get out of that nest.
Hey, can you tell me if there's a we have a local goshawk, and I don't know how close a cousin that is to the Cooper's hawk, but that goshawk is definitely keeping an eye out for chickens and other fowl that it can chomp on.
Yeah, I don't know their habits well enough to enlighten you as to how what they'll take and what they won't take.
Yeah, what they won't take.
You know, this Cooper's hawk that I had was we have pigeons and likes in the yard, but it was looking for smaller birds. And there was once again with this hawk in the yard. There was a woodpecker on our suet feeder that just froze there and stayed. It just looked like a piece of wood.
Yeah,
and the
smart.
Never
saw
picked it. Up on it. And everything else had disappeared. I mean, there were no birds.
Wow.
And the Cooper's hawk, to my knowledge, didn't get anything. And it eventually went away. So it had to work for a living, and it didn't collect one at our bird feeder.
Yeah.
So today we'll do a little bit of a wake up on the gloom and doom side, and then our guest will be Bob and Susan Sierna. And we've had them on once before. They head up a Citizens Climate Lobby in Vermont, but they have a long history of doing environmental things. I picked up on them. The newest edition, I believe, of Green Energy Times has an article on the importance of voting. That, and we'll get into that with them, and other things empowering things you can do to avoid that gloom and doom feeling, and feel as though there's something positive happening. And there certainly is a great deal happening. It's just that we're not making the switch and fixing the climate nearly as fast as we have to be. Business as usual is too ensconced. So maybe with that, I'll jump into to the worst of the gloom and doom, and I will post an article from The Guardian that seems to be a nice synopsis of it, and it's titled Gulf Stream Could Collapse as Early as 2025. So we're looking 2 years away.
1 year.
And yeah, 1 year, right?
1 year.
It might be late in the year.
Doom is coming sooner than you think. Yeah, there's a bit of a wide range. It's saying anywhere from 2025, I think, until maybe 2080, and they're picking a median point of maybe around 2050. If this estimate and if this is going to happen, but give us some details on it, Henry.
The scientists don't talk about this as the Gulf Stream. They talk it as the Atlantic Midroidal Overturning Circulation better known as
AMOC.
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 AMOC. Yeah. AMOC. Yes, I think AMOC's probably a good.
Let's
way to
go with AMOC. Yeah.
And this current circulates all the way from the Gulf Stream. Pretty much deals with Gulf of Mexico north up to up towards Greenland and sweeping around, keeping the Europe warm as well. It's why we can have palm trees in the southern tip of Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
It's all the Gulf Stream transferring that. And that's part of that circulation system. And that circulation system is basically a heat exchanger. It is taking the heat that would accumulate at the equator and spreading it out towards the poles. And it's driven by the saltiness of water and the weight of water. And within the Gulf Stream, you have a warm current moving north along the our Atlantic seaboard. And deep below it, you have a cold current that is going the other direction, going south. And that exchange is taking place because the colder water, as it moves towards the pole, the water gets colder and it sinks. And salty water is heavier than fresh water. And what's happening is that our climate change is actually happening five times faster at the polar regions than it is at the equator.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why so much of the sea ice is melting, and yet the people who are in mid-Atlantic states don't really see a big change in their weather. They're seeing bigger storms, but they aren't seeing all that much extra heat. We in Vermont are warming faster than the mid-Atlantic states, and the poles are warming faster than we are. And so when that polar ice melts, it is fresh water because that's fallen as snow and then been compacted into ice, and that's what's formed. What that water reservoir up there is. And when that fresh water flows into the ocean, it disrupts that. It stops that salty water from sinking and mixes with it. And basically can shut down that ocean current, has done multiple times in the past. And the shutdown from the geological record is very hard to measure. But they know that it's less than 100 years.
Mm.
And they think that it could be really short. It could be just 2 or 3 years. It's a very rapid onset when that shuts down and you stop getting the warmth transferred from the equator back up to the northern and southern latitudes. And people who study it are really worried about it. And it's, you know, we are feeding this by allowing runaway greenhouse gases, and that's what's making it more and more likely to happen. And there are many things that just the 1.1 degree C that we've already achieved are tipping points that we may have already passed due to that warming we've already done. And those include shutting down this AMOC, the collapse of the Greenland ice cap, which is more water, but also sea level rise, and the melting of carbon-rich permafrost, which is certainly taking place. and is a great methane producer, which is a strong greenhouse gas. And so we need to get off fossil fuel and start doing things that cool the planet instead. So that's the gloom part of it, and it's real, but we are seeing stuff on TV about floods and hurricanes and tornadoes, and those are probably our wake-up call, because this is so amorphous that we can't get our brains wrapped around it. So with that, I'll go get our guests who can help us find ways to not just put our head in the sand and say, oh my, I can't do anything about this. And who knows what's going to happen anyway.
Indeed. We'll hear back from Henry and our guests in just a moment. You're tuned to Green Zine here at Royalton Community Radio. Todd with you. And a little follow-up on the topic that we discussed with our guests last week, who is kind of the AI czar, for lack of a better term, here for the state of Vermont. We were talking about artificial intelligence, and we got into how much it could be contributing as far as the amount of electricity being used to the carbon problem. And Climate Forward, which is a newsletter sent out by the New York Times on Fridays, has a story about it. So I'm going to update you, and this starts to bring back in some things we were hearing about in the previous show, Radio EcoShock, about big corporations benefiting by an increase in the use of fossil fuels, which we're supposed to be decreasing, and also an increase in energy demand. From this Climate Forward, the boom in artificial intelligence has minted billions in paper wealth for tech giants like Microsoft and Amazon. But there's an overlooked set of winners as well, utilities and energy companies. The power demands of the huge data centers that underpin the AI revolution keep growing. Wall Street is taking notice, but the climate effect isn't getting as much attention. I'm sure that is so. AI boom is supercharging markets' interest in power. One side of investor enthusiasm, Standard & Poor 500 utility sectors, is up nearly 8% this year, outpacing the benchmark index overall. Tech's energy needs are coming into focus as investors get to grips with how much of an energy hog generative AI is becoming. Analysts at Wells Fargo, hate to mention so many corporate names, but they are in the story and they are huge users of energy, see the AI boom helping to push up U.S. electricity demand by as much as 20% by 2030. I thought we were going to try to use less energy. Shares in Dominion Energy last week after the company said it expected to supply 15 new data centers this year, some requiring a gigawatt or more of electricity. For perspective, a gigawatt powers about 750,000 homes. And Microsoft, our good friends at Microsoft, announced a $10 billion green energy deal with Brookfield Asset Management to supply electricity to some of its data centers. There's a hyperlink on that, and I might check that out to see how they're defining a green energy deal. The unfortunate part of all this added electricity being used for AI is it's largely going to run on fossil fuels. There's a push underway to ensure that this will transition over to lower carbon sources, and consider the Microsoft initiative or Amazon's $650 million acquisition of a Pennsylvania center that sits next to one of the biggest U.S. nuclear power plants. That's convenient. However, AI-power demands are likely to be fulfilled largely by natural gas this decade. According to the Wells Fargo analysts, that could throw a climate pledges of utilities and tech giants alike into disarray. I'm sure we'll be hearing more about this story in the future. And AI, you know, it's still sort of on the bubble, whether its positives outweigh its negatives when it comes particularly to energy use and carbon dioxide. Let's see if Henry's been able to connect with our guests. Henry,
I have, and yes, I'm back. And before we introduce Bob and Suzanne, let me just give you a good piece of news about that the gas demand The EPA has passed new rules which say that if you're building a gas peaking plant, a plant that only runs a very small percentage of the time to make up for dips when there isn't renewable energy available, they haven't changed the rules for how much carbon can be emitted. But if it is a gas plant that's going to run 24/7 to power an AI data center, that kind of thing, it actually has to be much greener than they are now. And it will, it's hoped that that regulation will drive us towards renewable energy instead of using natural gas burning for so much of our new electricity demand that will be coming on as we electrify everything and do AI. So just with that positive note, and there will be lawsuits and people trying to roll those regulations back. But I'd say if Biden makes it back into the White House, those rules will stick. And it'll be the reverse if our previous president takes over. So a factor for why it's important to vote. So without any further ado, let me say hi to Bob and Suzanne Ciernia, and welcome once again to Green Zine.
Thank you.
It's good to be here again.
Yeah, all welcome right. back. Good to hear from you.
So my thinking of having them on again, I think what they're doing is great. I think the Citizens Climate Lobby is a very effective group, but it was an op-ed piece that that Bob wrote for Green Energy Times that was talking about how we can actually change the playing field by getting involved. And so that's what kind of triggered my saying, oh, gee, we got to get them to come on and talk about empowering ourselves.
Yeah.
So give us a little background on kind of your grand sweep. You've been at climate action for years and years. Can you fill us in on that, and then we can maybe go over to a very brief description of CCL, and then we'll get into empowering
sure.
ourselves.
Sure, happy to do so. Personally, or as a couple, I think that Susanna and I fall into the category of being self-identified environmentalists, and we have been active in various environmental causes for, 40 years. Probably 10 years ago, 12 years ago, we didn't feel like we had been making much progress along those lines. And as we'll talk about here in a little bit, we found Citizens Climate Lobby, and it gave us a lot of hope that there was, in fact, the solution out there. And one of the current things that CCL is encouraging its members to do is participate in the Environmental Voter Project. And to give you a little background on that, it's an organization that is itself quite young, but their understanding was that there are large numbers of people who call themselves environmentalists, self-described, and EVP found that often, more often than one would wish, those people don't vote. And among the statistics that they came up with was that in 2020, there were 8 million environmentalists who hadn't voted. And in the midterms 2 years ago, there were 13 million people who hadn't voted. So they set themselves the task of how do we get these people involved and encourage them to become regular voters. They're a nonpartisan group with the idea being that it doesn't matter which party is talking about climate change or the environment. The more it's discussed, the more politicians pay attention to the topic, the more likely we're to see change in the legislature that would address it.
And one of the things I really like about EVP is that they measure their results, and they actually have been able to show that they made a significant difference in the 2020 election by their phone banking and their postcard calling, their postcards. So that's pretty cool. I mean, they just brought on a whole lot more votes. Well, not a whole lot more, because it doesn't take a whole lot more sometimes in these races. And that's the point that EVP makes, is that if you can just nudge those voters who are less, who have been found to be less likely to vote but who care about the environment, if you can nudge enough of them, you can swing the election to your favor.
Yeah, you know, on that subject, Susanna, it seems we're hearing, you know, obviously we're hearing mostly about the Gaza protests, but in the climate world, there are a lot of younger voters who don't traditionally vote in large numbers, regardless of whether they're neutral or they're conservative or they're liberal. And a lot of them are still pretty unhappy with moves by the federal government, maybe not so much by the individual states in the environmental movement. And I'm concerned whether that vote, which is very important, if indeed at somewhat environmental friendly administration remains in place. What's your take on trying to get more active voting at that sort of 18 to 35 age group?
Well, I think one of the things you can do is simply look at the Inflation Reduction Act that we were able to pass, and how much money was in it for climate, that it was a historical bill in terms of getting an administration and those elected in Congress to pass something that is spending just billions. I can't remember the number. Do you remember the number, Bob? It's a lot of money on climate, and that would not have happened without the votes. That it is a simple, logical connect the dots. If you don't vote, if we don't have enough votes, you don't get the people there who are going to pass the legislation that is going to enable us to put a price on carbon, put in incentives to help homeowners, the things that are real, practical, on-the-ground kind of things that consumers can do. And I think sometimes young people literally don't connect the dots. I think that civics and just understanding how laws are passed and how policies come into being is something we need to really educate people on more. There's certainly lots of flashpoints and hot-button issues, but the hard work of being in the trenches and getting people elected who will pass the policies that will enable the climate to start cooling, that's just basic, you know, trench stuff. And it's not sexy or hot button. It's just diligent work. And I think that's why it's not always on the radar for young people.
Mm-hmm. Let me jump in here and say that through my involvement with the Citizens Climate Lobby, I have been on several Zoom calls with congressional offices for our Vermont delegations. And the people who we're talking to try to get them to move ahead on more aggressive climate legislation, because I don't think we're going to solve the climate problem simply with personal choice. It's going to have to be regulatory before we're done, like this EPA numbers for gas generation of electricity. Those are going to be the big levers. And those, on those calls, the staff members are saying, yes, yes, we'd like to do all this, but we need other politicians, more people who we can work with, who will who are listening to their constituents and getting pressed to do better climate solutions than we're, you know, pay attention to it and actually put some effort in. And so that's part of the voting thing. It goes right back to turning out the vote and asking those questions of politicians so that it becomes a discussion on the campaign trail that then tends to trigger change. And I think, Bob, you have stories about about having seen changes that you've actually made happen just by increasing awareness.
Well, I do have two different stories. I'll follow up the one you were just talking about, that Senator Leahy's office, we moved to Vermont 5 years ago from Minnesota, and the group here in Vermont, Citizens Climate Lobby group, had been meeting with Senator Leahy's office for many years before we got here, and as he was leaving office, a member of his staff told us that his focus was agriculture, and he was skeptical of a carbon tax, whether it had CCL's preferred policy of giving all of the cash back to citizens or not. He expressed, the first time he heard about the idea, he was not just skeptical, probably opposed. As Senator Leahy left office, the staff member said, I became convinced that a carbon tax was absolutely essential to seeing real change from a societal viewpoint, and so made those comments known to the senator. It's people expect change very quickly, or desire change very quickly, but that's often not the way it happens. It takes time to hear what facts on the ground actually are and to absorb that and say that makes some sense. That one of the reasons that CCL, if we've been effective, and I think we have, but one of the reasons that it's effective is that there isn't an expectation of immediate change, that because we go back two or three times a year to the congressional offices and talk with staffers, we're trying to bring new information to them that gives them reasons to look at this legislation that we're supporting. And then I will go back to 2016 when I was in Minnesota. Again, the party is not important. It's the process that's important. I received a call from somebody who was looking for an endorsement for her party. And she asked me, what's your major concern? What are you talking about for this upcoming election? And I said, climate change is my, it is the central concern that will affect everything going forward. And we talked for about an hour, and I described Citizens Climate Lobby the way it operated, but also its primary policy goal of a charging polluters for the pollution they're putting into the environment, collecting that money and distributing it to citizens on a per capita basis. And she did not really seem, she thought, oh, that's interesting, but I didn't have a sense that she was going to be supportive of it. About 2 weeks later, I got a call from a friend who had just attended a fundraiser for this candidate and was told that the candidate had come out, referenced me by name and Citizens Climate Lobby, and said that this was the kind of legislation that was needed to pass or to address climate change. That person is now a representative from Minnesota in Congress and has supported numerous climate change pieces of legislation. So my point is that you never know what's going to result in a happier outcome than could have been expected had you done nothing.
Yeah. So I understand that National Public Radio has been requesting from people what they questions they would like to have asked of people who are to be elected officials. And I think this is a time that we can weigh in and ask those questions that will be broadcast to a big audience when those questions are asked.
And, I would certainly agree with that. And I think particularly for whether they are current representatives or simply candidates, if they believe that climate change is in fact an existential threat to civilization, perhaps our species, then, well, so how seriously are you taking this and what are you willing to propose and support to effect some sort of legislation that would change the course that we appear to be on?
Yeah. All right. So
we've got a bill.
come back to the work of the Environmental Voters Project. Can you give us a way that we that our listeners can get connected to that?
Sure.
What you'd recommend?
Sure. As the article points out, there's a high propensity of people who list the environment as one of their top priorities, and yet they are one of the largest groups of people who are least likely to vote. It seems a contradiction in terms, but that's what the statistics show. And there are a couple of different ways to get involved. If you go to their website, EVP, or environmentalvoterproject.org, you can sign up for alerts for when they're going to do phone banking. I've done phone banking many times, and I can give you a blow-by-blow. It's a simple process. All you need is a cell phone and your laptop, and you just sit in a quiet place, and they walk you through it. You get a script. You are not telling people how to vote. You're simply offering them information that there's an election, maybe a special election coming up next Tuesday. Do you know where you need to go to vote? Have you already voted? They're very basic, neutral questions. And you just sit there on the phone, and it automatically dials, and you use your script, and it helps. It goes for about an hour, and then there's a debriefing afterwards. You can pick the weeknights. Last time I did it with the 2020 election, every Thursday night I was phone banking. It was just I put it on my calendar. And then you can also write postcards. If you really don't want to talk on the phone, you can write postcards. And the beauty of a postcard is that people see it no matter what. You don't have to wait for them to open an envelope or, you know, just throw it in the trash. Their curiosity takes over. They flip it over, and it simply has a simple statement about, here's where the election's going to be. Don't forget to vote. They're pretty basic actions, and it's hard to believe that enough people doing this can swing elections, but it does work, and that's one of the beauties of it. So EVP or environmentalvoterproject.org is where you go.
And I see that you've got one scheduled for May 15th, Environmental Voter Phone Bank with Citizens Climate Lobby, so there's plenty of time for people to get ready for that. That'll be 7 p.m. next Wednesday.
That's right. And that's the CCL group. They have other groups that they partner with. So if Wednesday nights are not good for you, there are other times that you can sign up. I mean, that one happens to be the CCL-affiliated one, but there are other opportunities as well.
Excellent.
And I'll have links for that up on our Green Zine link site at the bottom of the homepage for the station. So
great.
You can
Thank you.
Follow it there.
Well, this
and,
is.
And if I could add that I think that a lot of us make the assumption that people who, are putting panels up on their houses, or they care about take basic things like recycling or composting, or they enjoy walks in the woods, and they're members of the Audubon Society or whatever. All of those things would indicate that they are thinking about what's happening to the planet, to the environment. It doesn't necessarily translate into politics. That politics is something that a lot of people think is either inherently bad, if not evil, or is disassociated from their own lives.
Or dysfunctional.
Or dysfunctional, right. And they don't want the stress. They don't want the stress. They don't want the difficulty of talking to their neighbors or whomever. And so they've removed themselves from what is arguably the single most important part of actually affecting the environment. Who gets elected makes a huge difference in the long-term results on the planet. And it's important, or at least from my viewpoint, that we be talking about that as a typical part of our routine, that to bring it up and say it is happening. It needs more than individuals doing the right thing. It's going to take the only institution large enough to address what is the biggest problem humanity's ever faced.
Yeah.
I was just going to add one thing that I think,
sure,
especially
sure.
as the point was made earlier about younger people, I think every chance we get, we should engage with young voters to make sure they understand the impact that vote has, because I think a lot of them have tuned it out. It's just kind of, oh, yeah, right, that doesn't help. No, I think that statistically it has been shown over and over again, especially the EVP statistics, that it does help. It does make a difference. So I think we need to have those conversations with younger voters as well.
Well,
and I'll just tag on one more thing, that in a number of states, the difference between an environmental candidate winning and an environmental candidate losing can be a few thousand votes. And so if there are, it doesn't matter, 8 or 13 million environmentalists who don't vote, if a small percentage of them, 3%, 5% vote, that is more than enough to swing states that are purple states, where the choice could be between an environmentalist who will think about the climate when they vote versus someone who will more than likely support business interests that will continue to enact business as usual legislation.
Just one quick statistic from the last election, the 2020 election. The EVP project targeted Arizona in that election. They got 56,990 new voters to cast early ballots. Biden won that state by 10,000 votes.
Wow.
So those numbers really do make a difference. It's incremental.
Yeah. Wow. Well, Bob and Susanna, really appreciate you sharing this information, getting people active when it comes time to vote.
And let me just ask you to, in closing, say how it makes you feel when you actually take action and do something. Because I think that's the gloom and doom thing that we get trapped in, that we don't do anything. And
Right. Well, you know, the great quote, I think it's Joan Baez, but I could be wrong, is action is the antidote to despair. So when you're talking with people and they just shut it out, they I can't think about it. It's like, no, try this. Here, you want to write postcards with me on Wednesday night, or you want a phone bank? Do something. And again, back it up with the numbers. It actually does help. It makes a difference.
Great.
So action is the antidote to despair.
I like that. I'll keep using that.
Thank you. All right. Well, great to have you on, and thank you for the good work you're doing. And we all need to join in that activity. And I like the idea of actually having a regular routine thing on your calendar that you make set aside a little bit of time on an ongoing basis to do, rather than just having it be when the spirit moves you.
Yeah, it's just a regular thing leading up to the election. I think it makes it easier almost.
All right. Yeah. Well, thanks again for joining us, Bob and Susanna. We'll hope to talk again maybe in the near future.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. Keep up the good work.
Great. We'll do.
Bye-bye. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, Henry, I'm experimenting here, and I'm not getting anywhere with it. Let me see if that helps. Nope. I had a recording of some peepers down in Norwich, but I'll have to try to bring the peepers out next week. Around where we live, the peepers have been kind of pretty quiet. We're a little bit concerned about that. But I'm going to stick in the natural world for right now. I am at the Northern Woodlands week-by-week sort of documentation from Elise Tillinghast about what's happening out in the woods and other places. And I did start the show with a fiddlehead song, and she's making note that ostrich fern fiddleheads have been out, and she describes what they look like and also mentions that if you get them at the right time, don't over-harvest them. But with a little salt and butter, they are pretty tasty. She also mentions that bald eagle chicks are growing quickly, and by this point, many have shed their white baby fuzz. She's got pictures of this. So if you want to check this out, go to the Northern Woodlands website at northernwoodlands.org. And got something else here? Go ahead.
Yeah, just a quick note on bald eagles. Bald eagles actually lay their eggs very early because they take so long to mature. They need as many days in the nest as they can so they can fledge before it gets to be fall time.
Wow.
So that's how the bald eagles are already, other birds may only just be laying their first eggs, and bald eagles are already chicks are already changing their feathers.
Hey, Henry, I got another item I want to squeeze in. We've got about 5 minutes left in the show, and don't worry, get your dancing shoes on. We will be heading out with a waltz courtesy of a great artist named Peter Ostrushko. Henry referenced getting some information out of the current Green Energy Times. It is out and about, certainly in our area and all over, certainly the northern half of Vermont. It is the April, May, and June issue, and on page 8, you will find a story about a microgrid that's being put together And it's called, the official name of it, because it's over in the Brandon area, is the Rochester Brandon Mountain Resilience Zone. So it's called the RBM. And it's going to be over there in Rochester. And what it's going to exist is a 1,000 kilowatt solar array with a 2,000 kilowatt battery that will be there. So that, of course, Rochester was one of the most hard hit towns in many reasons, but certainly taken off the grid for quite a while during her tropical storm Irene. The project's being put together by someone that we may want to talk to in the future about this project, Henry. I'll send you his contact info offline, Kevin Davis of Norwich Solar. And what's pretty interesting about this, and you've heard the term agrovoltaics, the site where this is going to be, it's not under construction yet, but I think later this year they will break ground. We often hear about agrovoltaics, so it should be no surprise that the installation would be on a farm and that it will continue to engage in farming on the same land. What is surprising is the type of farming that will be done in this case. And Henry, I know you are a meat eater. The land is part of North Hollow Farm, which specializes in 100% grass-fed, natural-raised beef. Norwich Solar is designing the array to stand up to cattle grazing beneath the panels, though some of the solar array will be on an old sand pit. The batteries will be on a piece of land adjacent to the site of the array. So good to see that combination of factors and also sort of energy, renewable energy resilience in our neighborhood, just over the hill there in Rochester.
Yes, indeed. That is great news. I think Green Mountain Power is planning to do a few experimental microgrids, and I don't know if that one is one of theirs.
It is. It is. No, it is the very first one. So it's kind of the debut, but they are expecting to build several other ones around the state of Vermont.
Yeah, so they're testing out the concept on the ground to see how it works out, and that's great news for them doing that. And it's one of the the trade-offs. How much do we depend on the grid, and how much do we depend on locally generated power? And I think it needs to be a balance, and getting that balance right so it works for everybody is the tricky part. So I have another item that has to do with good news, and that is, again, the EPA has new rules to clean up heavy trucking. And they are setting emissions on trucks all the way from local trucks and city buses to 18-wheelers, and that's going to drive the trucking industry towards electric vehicles, and the grid will need to find out a way of delivering enough power to recharge a fleet. You know, when you have a whole fleet of trucks going back to home base and want to power up overnight, they absorb some energy. So but that's, you know, that's again, the EPA has gotten the court ruling that that CO2 is a detrimental greenhouse gas and that they can regulate it.
Another piece that we won't,
in the process.
Yeah, one piece that we won't get to today, we're running out of time, is notes coming in from noted environmentalist Bill McKibben, a column about All About the Gas. We will get to that next week. I'm going to take time, and I did find the peepers, Henry, so you're going to be hearing peepers pretty soon.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah, we'll wrap up with some peepers here in just about 1 minute. Green Zine is brought to you by the generous financial support of Solar Fest and also Solaflect, so we have those kind of rhyme together. Bale, Royal Trailworks, Daniel Leibowitz, the Upper Pass Beer Company, First Branch Coffee Company, and the White River Land Collaborative, which definitely has an environmental ethos. They have planted a number of trees to make the bank of the First Branch a lot more resilient, because unfortunately more floods are coming. And we'll look forward to joining you next week. We can give you a heads up about a couple things. We'll probably be announcing the environmental topic, a Hot Topics in Environmental Law series, which is due to begin in 2 weeks here at the Vermont Law and Graduate School. And Henry, I think we're going to get these peepers going. Let's give them a try.
All right.
Here we go. You've been listening to, yeah, there they are. You've been listening to WFERLP in South Royalton. We'll see you next week.